Lecture 23, Han Yu to Zhu Xi, Neo-Confucianism.
Hello, it's good to have you with me again. We are now nearly two-thirds of the way through this course, and at this point, meaning of life overload may be setting in. You might be saying, oh dear, not another explanation of the nature of reality, a whole new set of terms and concepts. But hold on for just one more major system of thought, Neo-Confucianism. You'll find that it's not entirely new. Just as modern classical music, which can sometimes sound kind of strange or atonal, jarring, may be bewildering at first, until you realize that it's responding to several centuries of musical development. In the same way, you're now in a position to make sense of Neo-Confucianism, because you've heard about the Chinese and the Indian philosophies that it borrows from and then adapts. In contrast with what we've seen in Hinduism and in Buddhism, Neo-Confucianism is much less concerned with the nature of the soul or the afterlife, and it doesn't really even mention God. As you might expect in China, it quickly gets to issues of ethics and how people ought to live. And since Neo-Confucianism was the dominant philosophy in China for nearly 700 years, that's much longer than modern science has been around, Neo-Confucianism has profoundly affected the lives of millions. In the next two lectures, we'll be tracing the course of Neo-Confucianism in China from its origins in the 9th century. But let's start with some historical background. Buddhism and religious Taoism became popular in China after the fall of the Han Dynasty in the 3rd century AD. They picked up followers and government support and continued to make progress even after China was reunited in the 7th century under the Tang Dynasty. This was a dynamic era, remembered today for both its poetry and its military successes. Kind of an interesting combination. Tang Dynasty, great poetry, great military power as well. China expanded west and controlled the Silk Road all the way to Samarkand, a city now in Uzbekistan, which is north of Afghanistan. And it's nearly 3,000 miles from the Chinese capital. Okay, think about it. That is amazing that before mechanized transportation, the Chinese were able to exert military power 3,000 miles from their capital. China during the Tang Dynasty was stable and prosperous, and the four major schools of Buddhism that we talked about earlier were all doing well. Remember the Tiantai school, which likes the Lotus Sutra as the highest form of Buddhism, and in which everything has the Buddha nature. The second is the Huayin school, which likes the Huayin or Flower Garland Sutra, in which everything is interconnected and interpenetrating. The Pure Land school, where people hope to be reborn after they die into a paradise created by the Bodhisattva Amitabha. And then the fourth school is Chan, or Zen Buddhism, which focuses on the practice of meditation. There were merchants and diplomats and scholars from all over Asia that came to the capital at Xi'an. You may remember Xuanzang, the great Buddhist Chinese pilgrim who went to India and brought back scriptures, and he was set up in the capital at Xi'an for his translation project there. And there were students that came not only from China but Korea and Japan as well to work with him. The city, this is Xi'an, also had a small population of Zoroastrians, Manichaeans, and Christians, and in this case they are actually Nestorian Christians from Persia. They are Christians who were the losers in some of the theological disputes back in the Middle East, and they went to Persia, and then from Persia they came to China. The last king of the Persian Sassanid Empire also ended up in Xi'an after he was defeated by the Muslims of the Abbasid Caliphate in 651. So China, and especially the capital at Xi'an, is a very cosmopolitan, wealthy place. It's open to ideas and goods coming in from India and from Central Asia, and it was admired and imitated in Tibet and Korea and Japan. And then it all nearly collapsed. There was a massive civil war called the An Lushan Rebellion that lasted from 755 to 763. So a census taken in just before the war, in 754, set the population of China at 53 million. A decade later, after the rebellion, a new census counted only 17 million. Okay. That doesn't mean that 36 million people perished. they lost track of that many people. I mean, there were millions of people who died, but there were always also millions and millions who became refugees and who were disappeared from the tax registers and the government lost track of. The central government lost track of a lot of things, lost power as well to local warlords. And indeed, the dynasty, the Tang dynasty, only survived because nomadic peoples like the Uyghurs propped it up with military assistance. In all of that turmoil, China lost control of the Silk Road, and it began to turn inward. Foreigners and foreign ideologies were all viewed with suspicion, as many intellectuals decided that China's survival depended on its reconnecting with its own cultural heritage. Okay, as you might have guessed, Neo-Confucianism has something to do with Confucius. And I'll tell you about some of the early figures in this Back to Confucius movement, and then the man who'll bring everything together, Zhu Xi. That is a hard name to spell. It is Z-H-U, Zhu, and X-I, Xi. But we're going to start with Han Yu. He lives from 768 to 824, so that's going to make him a contemporary of Charlemagne. Han Yu was born shortly after the An Lushan Rebellion. He was orphaned at the age of 2 and then raised in the family of his older brother. He eventually passed the civil service exams, actually on his fourth try. They're very difficult. And he became a government official. He was an extraordinary writer who tried to recreate the simple and direct literary style of ancient Chinese. That was the language that was used, the classical language of the Confucian classics and Mencius and Sima Qian. And as he went back to that, he re-energized Chinese literature. At his time, in the Tang Dynasty, people were writing in something called parallel prose, which was very flowery and very ornate and very structured into parallel things. And he goes back to sort of this more direct mode of expression. In 805, Han Yu wrote an essay entitled Essentials of the Moral Way. And that title can also be translated as An Inquiry on the Tao. Remember, that's the way. And in this essay, Han Yu suggested that Chinese civilization should be defined by Confucianism, a point which he made explicitly by criticizing both Taoism and Buddhism. Han Yu argued that the world is real, okay, so it's not an illusion, as some Taoists were saying. He says that there are absolute standards of right and wrong. This is sort of against Taoists a little bit, where everything is relative. And Han Yu says that people have responsibilities to family and to country, and to their society. Once again, this is against the monasticism that came in with, actually, by this time, both Taoism and Buddhism, people withdrawing from families, not paying taxes, not serving in the armies. Han Yu concluded his essay by asserting that the real Tao is the way of the sage kings, and that was transmitted to Confucius, and from Confucius it went to Mencius, and from there it wasn't passed on. I mean, Xunzi, remember the guy who said that human nature is evil, he only sort of got it. But the Taoists and the Buddhists today, they do not have this transmission of the authentic way. Okay, 14 years after this essay, in 1819, Han Yu went even further in a famous letter to the emperor in which he complained about the generous treatment being extended to a relic of the Buddha. This was supposedly a finger bone of the Buddha that had been carefully preserved at the Dharma Gate Monastery, which was about 75 miles west of Xi'an. This monastery claimed that it was established by Ashoka, the great Buddhist king of India. Remember him? Okay, that can't be true. There was not Buddhism in China as long ago as Ashoka. But in China, remember, the older the better, so people made these sorts of claims. Okay, back to this finger bone relic. Every 30 years, the monks in this monastery would take this relic out of storage and carry it to the capital in a stately procession. The year 819 marked the 8th time that this had happened, and the emperor had prepared a grand welcoming ceremony. Okay. Han Yu was appalled by this, and he wrote a memorial to the emperor explaining his reasoning. Okay. Here's a loose paraphrase, so these are his arguments. Han Yu says, China has been much more chaotic ever since the arrival of Buddhism. Chinese Buddhist rulers, the emperors who have adopted Buddhism, have all had unhappy short reigns. And Buddhism encourages people to waste their time and to harm their bodies in foolish, superstitious practices. Han Yu says, the Buddha was a foreigner who didn't speak Chinese and didn't understand the proper ways of civilization. He wouldn't have understood filial piety, respect for parents, or respect for rulers. If the Buddha showed up today in person, you, as the emperor, might give him a dinner, give him a change of clothes, and then you'd have him escorted out of China before he led people astray. But now his decayed finger bone comes to the Capitol, and you're giving this extravagant reception for this disgusting, decomposing object. I know that you're just humoring the masses, but people might see your behavior and think that you actually believe this nonsense. Why don't you just burn the stupid thing or throw it into the river to set the record straight? And if there's any divine power attached to it, to this finger bone, may all of the consequences of destroying it fall upon me. Okay, this is basically his argument. Unfortunately, the emperor was more of a believer than Hanyu had assumed, and Hanyu was nearly executed for those strong criticisms. At the end of this interaction between them, Hanyu wasn't killed, but he was exiled to a post far to the south in present-day Guangdong province near Hong Kong. There, Hanyu continued to advocate for Confucian values, though he certainly wasn't violently anti-Buddhist. I mean, he had several close friendships throughout his life with Zen Buddhist monks. Here's another story of Hanyu. I'd like to tell stories about him. While he was in the south, there was a problem with a man-eating crocodile. Hanyu composed an essay, reminded the crocodile in the most eloquent, forceful terms, this great literary Chinese, that all under heaven were subject to the emperor's authority. And that included not just people, but also animals, and this particular crocodile. So as the emperor's official representative, he, Hanyu, was ordering the crocodile to move on within 3 days. And he threw a copy of this into the river. And then a large storm came up, and the next thing anyone heard was that the crocodile had left the district and was now many miles downriver. That Hanyu could really write. Let me give you two later updates as to what's happening with Buddhism in China. In 845, a Taoist emperor initiated massive persecutions of foreign religions. The communities, small communities of Zoroastrians and Christians in the capital came to an end. Thousands of Buddhist temples were destroyed, and tens of thousands of monks and nuns were forced back into regular life. They were laicized. Buddhists were unable to keep separate, tightly organized schools going, as happened in Japan, though Buddhism by this time had deeply penetrated popular culture. So there's still a lot of Buddhism around, but it's less organized. Do you remember I talked about the Nestorian Christians? In 781, they had erected a 9-foot-tall limestone monument in one of their churches with inscriptions in both Chinese and Syriac. It talked about their religion a little bit and how the emperor had thought this religion was okay and had allowed them to be in the country, etc. This monument was buried in 845 during this time of persecution, and then it was rediscovered again in 1625 when Jesuit missionaries were in China. The Catholic priests were astonished to learn of a Chinese Christian community that had preceded them by 8.5 centuries. Update number 2. The finger bone of the Buddha was brought out of the Dharma Gate Monastery just one more time after Hanyu's death, and then it was lost in the chaos of the late Tang Dynasty. Lost, that is, until an earthquake in 1981, which brought down half of a pagoda, so just sort of sheared it in half at the Dharma Gate Monastery. And then a few years later, as workers were doing renovations, they discovered a secret underground vault that contained a set of 7 nestled boxes, right? So each box is smaller and inside the others. And those boxes are made of gold and silver and jade. And when you get to the very smallest box, inside was the finger bone relic. That relic has since traveled to Hong Kong, to Korea, and to Taiwan. In 2009, a stupa was constructed for it, which, at 485 feet high, is the world's tallest stupa. So, sorry, Hanyu. But he's still one of the great minds of the Eastern intellectual tradition. At a time when it looked like Buddhism or even Neo-Daoism might eclipse the teachings of Confucius, Hanyu once again made Confucianism vital and exciting. Okay. The Tang Dynasty fell in 907, and then there were 5 dynasties in 50 years. We call that the 5 Dynasties period. And then we get the Song Dynasty, which lasts from 960 to 1279. This was a period of great urban and commercial expansion. China became prosperous through better seeds and agricultural methods, so they're able to sustain a larger population. There were also innovations in shipbuilding, in tea processing, in the manufactures of porcelain, and in ironworking. Paper money was used for the first time in world history in Song Dynasty China. But China at this period was always threatened by nomadic peoples to the north and to the west. In fact, Nomads took over all of North China about halfway through the dynasty. So trade started to go by sea across the Indian Ocean rather than by land across the Silk Road. And as a result, China's coastal cities became wealthy. And that's actually a pattern that's continued to this day. The coast is much more prosperous than the hinterlands, the inner regions of China. The population grew, as did an elite class of scholar officials who could devote their attention to art, literature, gardens, and philosophy. Scholarship flourished as education and books increased, partly because of printing, which really takes off in China. This is like 500 years before Gutenberg. It becomes popular in part because they've got paper. So books become much cheaper, much more widespread. I'm going to run through four names rather quickly of important figures in the development of Neo-Confucian philosophy. All of them lived in the 11th century. They are all four scholar officials. But what I want you to do is keep in mind the big name that's coming up. That's Zhu Xi. All right, you ready for four quick names? The first is Zhou Dunyi. And he wrote an explanation of the diagram of the great ultimate. This was a chart from Taoist alchemy that illustrated the process of creation. Okay, it's mostly a series of vertical circles, which Zhou Dunyi reinterpreted in Confucian terms. It starts at the top with the great ultimate, which is also the ultimate of non-being. You can see that we're in Taoist territory here. And then it proceeds downwards through the alternation of yin and yang, and then to the interactions of the five phases. Remember, those are water, fire, wood, metal, and earth. And then from there to the origins of male and female, which gives rise to the production of the myriad things, which are naturally imbued with the four virtues of benevolence, righteousness, propriety, and wisdom. Okay, those are the four virtues that Mencius thought were innate in everyone. Remember when he told the story about the child who was about to fall into the well and everybody feels this sort of momentary panic or that's a natural compassion. The details of that chart aren't so important. What matters is that Zhou Dunyi is trying to reach back into Chinese tradition to come up with a metaphysical explanation of the universe, much like those provided by Tiantai Buddhists or Huayan Buddhists. And Zhou was actually an admirer of Buddhism. He was trying to find a way to connect human ethics with the workings of the cosmos so that Confucian morality could be set on a natural, universal foundation. In many ways, his project is reminiscent of Han Confucianism, but he's a much more systematic and rational in his approach than was Dong Zhongshu. Remember, way back in lecture 16. One more thing. Zhou Dunyi was a teacher, and he was much beloved by his students, who reported that his love for life was so strong that he could not bear to cut the grass outside his window. Now, there's a man after my own heart. I wish that I had such a noble reason for my lawn looking so ragged and overgrown. Okay, our next figure is Zhang Zai. He was trained in Confucianism as a young man, but then he was disappointed in what he had learned. He spent several years studying Buddhism and Taoism, and then eventually returned to the Confucian classics. Like Buddhists and Hindus, he asserted that the universe is one thing with multiple manifestations. And that one thing for Zhang Zai is qi, which it means energy, but it's an energy that can be congealed maybe into ordinary matter. So it sometimes is translated as material force. So some sort of force that in some circumstances becomes tangible, and it makes up everything. Zhang Zai wrote an extremely influential essay called The Western Inscription, and it was written on the west wall, posted on the west wall of his study. Now, listen as he combines metaphysics with Confucian filial piety. And this is so good, I just want to read it to you here. He says, "Heaven is my father, and earth is my mother. And even such a small creature as I finds an intimate place in their midst. Therefore, that which fills the universe I regard as my body, and that which directs the universe I consider as my nature. All people are my brothers and sisters, and all things are my companions." In other words, the cosmos is a family, that there's a direct connection between heaven and earth and human beings as well. He's doing something extraordinary here. One of the weaknesses of the Confucian family-based system of morality is there's no clear definition of what we owe to strangers. Okay. Remember the five Confucian relationships? Ruler to subject, parents to children, husband to wife, older brother to younger brothers, friend to friend. So what do you owe to people that you don't know at all, that you're not connected to in those ways? Buddhism, by contrast, has a strong ethic of compassion for all people, even for animals. Zhang Zai is saying that because everything shares the basic substance of qi, then all people are my brothers and sisters, and all things are my companions. So he's going to provide a universal ethic of Confucianism. Okay, two more thinkers. These are the brothers Cheng Hao and Cheng Yi, who were both students of Zhou Dunyi. They were also students of Zhang Zai, who was their uncle. And they, you can distinguish their philosophies, but they're pretty close, so most people talk about them together. They add one more key idea to the mix, and that is the idea of principle. This is Li, and it's unfortunately the same tone, the same sound as the word that means ritual early on. But this is principle, we'll put it with a capital P. It's an idea that had already been put forward by Huayan Buddhist monks like Fazang when he wrote about his sermon on the golden lion, that there was this principle that was in every part of that. So Li, or principle, is the pattern that gives form to everything. It's a universal law or universal morality, a sort of pervasive order that gives shape to physical objects and social relations. So there's a Li of mountains, right? An ideal of mountains, and a Li of horses, and a Li of motherhood, and a Li of family, filial piety. It's sort of like Plato's ideals, but it's never found in abstract form. Li is always manifest in something. So Li is the principle by which fire is hot and water is cold. Okay, I know that you can make water hot, but that's sort of not its natural principle. And there's ultimately just one principle in the world with a lot of manifestations in different things, and that's identical to human nature. So in other words, the Li of a human being is in some sense that of heaven or of the natural world. These are the four most important philosophers of the early Song Dynasty, but there's a whole string of extremely talented, impressive statesmen, many of whom were also fine writers and poets and historians, and they put Confucianism into practice with vigorous debates on how best to help the common people and strengthen the nation. I'll spare you a long list of Chinese names, but this really is a remarkable time in Chinese history, a time when statecraft and these statesmen were very engaged with each other and doing brilliant sorts of things. And then finally, we come to Zhu Xi. He lives from 1130 to 1200, and he's the one who pulls all of this together. He's living about a century after these thinkers that we talked about before. Zhu Xi was born in South China. He passed the civil service exams at the age of 18, which is an indication of his brilliance. Most men pass them in their 30s, early 30s. He served on and off in various government positions. He made enemies with his criticisms of corrupt or incompetent officials, and he eventually established the White Deer Grotto Academy, where he taught. Zhu Xi and a friend put together an anthology of selections of key teachings of the four thinkers I've just mentioned. And this book is called Reflections on Things at Hand. And they compiled this for the benefit of people living in remote areas who didn't have access to teachers. And this book was a very influential textbook. It inspired commentaries on it, not just in China, but also in Korea and in Japan, remote areas indeed. Zhu Xi synthesized what had been said before, and he taught that Li, the principle that was espoused by the Cheng brothers, is actually the great ultimate of Zhou Dunyi's diagram. So Li is the pattern, and Qi is the substance that embodies it. You can't have Li without Qi, or you can't have this material force without principle. It's like the design of a house, right? You've got a design, and then on the other side, you've got the bricks and the lumber and the nails that actually go into it. This is why mountains can be different from each other, or why mothers are not all the same, even though there's a single Li for each type of object, right? Every mountain is more or less follows this principle of mountainness, but there's a variety in the kind of stuff that makes that up. and that might differ in quality. Okay, this is important because Juxi wants to agree with Mencius that human nature is good. But then he has to explain where evil comes from. And his answer is qi. He says that the li of human beings, the principle, is always good and pure. But qi, that material force or substance that fills out the li, that can be impure or corrupt. Again, the design of a house may be perfect, but the particular 2x4s that are used can sometimes be warped. Okay, now this isn't like Manichaean dualism, where spirit is good and matter is evil, because qi is not necessarily bad. I mean, it can be good or bad, sort of like lumber can be straight or crooked, which is why people who all share the same li can turn out to be moral or immoral depending on their qi. So people have unique talents and horses have different temperaments and oak trees may be tall or short. I mean, it all depends on their qi as it takes shape through development and interactions. So even your mind is made of qi. So some people's minds are sort of sharper or purer than others. And the two souls, I think I mentioned this before, that in China you have two souls, an yin soul and a yang soul. Those souls are made of qi as well. I mean, there's nothing that's pure li. So just as the term Confucianism is a Western name for what the Chinese called Ruism, remember the school of Ru, the classicists, so also the Chinese word for Neo-Confucianism doesn't include the name of the ancient philosopher. Instead, in Chinese, Juxi's thought is referred to as Li Xue, the study of Li. Not only did Juxi synthesize the cosmological ideas of Li and Qi and the great ultimate, but he also brought the key Confucian ideals of sincerity and benevolence into the mix. So Ren, remember that word for benevolence, is not just a human virtue. Ren is a cosmic force that can be found in everything. Juxi believed with Zhang Zai that all people are brothers and sisters because of the principle that they share, the Li, which is ultimately the same principle that's found in everything. And his analogy is, just as there's only one moon, but its light can be seen shining on thousands of lakes and rivers at the same time, so also there's just one Li that is reflected in all things, all people. Or, as he wrote elsewhere, there is principle before there can be material force. So principle is superior, comes first. But it is only when there is material force that principle finds a place to settle. This is the process by which all things are produced, whether as large as heaven and earth or as small as ants. So Confucius' ideas about benevolence and sincerity, Mencius' ideas about this innate goodness of human beings, theories of yin and yang, the five phases, and 11th century Neo-Confucian thought, all gets brought by Juxi together, in addition to a few of the teachings of Taoists and Buddhists. And all of that is combined into a rational, consistent, satisfying whole. Okay, by now, perhaps you're beginning to sense Juxi's contributions to Chinese metaphysics. He's answering Buddhist questions about the nature of reality and the relationship between humans and the world, but his answers are taken from the Confucian classics. So Juxi is regularly compared to Thomas Aquinas in the West. He's someone who's synthesized and systematized an entire tradition of thought, but he did so without writing a magnum opus like the Summa Theologica. Juxi's ideas are generally expressed in his letters, in notes of his conversations that were written down by his students, a little bit like the Analects of Confucius, and also by his commentaries on the classics. And in that, he's like the great Hindu Vedanta philosopher Shankara. Still, though, you may wonder if Juxi's metaphysical speculations really make him, as so many have said, the most important, the most influential Chinese thinker after Confucius, Mencius, Laozi, and Zhuangzi. Okay. That's a strong claim, but we're only halfway through Juxi's accomplishments. In addition to explaining the cosmos, he also made significant contributions to education, to politics, epistemology, ethics, and personal development in what Confucians call self-cultivation. It turns out that Neo-Confucianism is a supremely practical philosophy, as we'll see in the next lecture.